Welcome to the Growth Equation Podcast. We're your hosts, Brad Stahlberg
and Steve Magnus.
And we're interested in exploring the art, science, and practice of performance and well-being.
Whether on the playing field, in the office, or in the classroom, the principles of sustainable success are the same. There's a lot of noise and nonsense out there in this space. Our goal is to cut to the signal. And welcome to another episode of the Growth Equation Podcast. I'm Steve Magnus and joined by my co-author and friend, Brad Stahlberg. Today on the podcast, we're going to talk about experts on everything and certainty and the illusion of science. So this is a topic I'm really excited about because as you know, Brad, in my other part of life, I am a science nerd. So I love this topic and I'm looking forward to diving into it.
Yeah, I feel like you open up every podcast with a topic that you're excited about. You're a curious cat, my friend Steve. But I think this is going to be a good topic. I think that it's really timely right now in the midst of this virus that is literally been identified as a novel, which means new virus. So we're getting to watch science unfold in real time, and it is exposing some of science's inherent vulnerabilities. It's also perhaps making people realize that science is so important and we need to depend on it. And it's opening up the door for people to take alternative approaches to science. So we can really dive in and evaluate all of those things on this podcast.
Awesome. So let's do this. Let's start by defining science, and then we'll go into kind of experts on everything. And I think the defining of science is important because I think a lot of us have this misunderstanding of what science is, right? We tend to think of it in the same way that we learned it in middle school and high school, which is memorize a bunch of facts, like understand some biology or chemistry, understand the facts so that we can, or understand the facts so that we can ace our tests and then move on from it. But in reality, science isn't this memorization. It's a way of thinking. It's a process to find the solution, to find the answer. And the way I kind of like to look at it is, science is about kind of going into this clearing, this path, right? And having all of these different options of paths we could take and not knowing which one is correct. And science is about slowly, gradually, through testing, through experimentation, like finding what paths not to take. And then eventually you're left with the path that is most likely right, right? So it's disproving your theory, your hypothesis, is not necessarily proving.
A huge part of science is asking how we might be wrong. I think zooming out from what you said, Steve, for listeners, the key take-home point here is that science very rarely tells you what to think with certainty. It tells you how to think and what to think based on probability. So the scientific method is every bit as much as it is getting to an answer, it is a way of getting to an answer. So it's how do you evaluate information? How do you test information? How do you take humility with your opinion? What will it take for you to change your opinion as new evidence becomes available? So I think that something that's worth pointing out, and I have to catch myself when I say this, is that there are some things that based on years of science in the balance of evidence, science can tell us what to think. So a couple examples that I like are that sewage and sanitation work. That is unequivocally true with a capital T. Vaccines work. Again, unequivocally true with a capital T. There was some fraudulent researchers about 20 years ago that wrote a very provocative paper tying vaccines to autism, and science did exactly what it was supposed to do. It very quickly disproved that person. As an aside, unfortunately, that myth refuses to die hard, but from a scientific standpoint, it's very clear that that is true with a capital T. Smoking is very harmful for you. Again, it took time. Surgeon General didn't know that for a very long time, but over time, science proved with a capital T that that is a truth. So science does get us to some certainties. It just takes a lot of time. And again, I think why this episode is so prescient right now is we're going through something new, we're craving certainty, and we don't yet have it because science takes time.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a good point there. And when we don't have the time to let the process work out, it can be incredibly frustrating, and it can be easy to blame science, right? You know, one of the things that I've heard for most of my life living in kind of the science world is relatives, family members, friends who make comments like, well, you know, last month, science told me that eggs were bad. And then this month, they told me that eggs were good to eat. So what is it? And they almost throw their hands up and say, like, oh, they can't come to answer. We shouldn't listen to anything. But I think what you're pointing there, even on things like smoking, which took a while to figure out, is that back and forth is part of the process, right? It's having to do enough research, enough work to understand where that capital T truth is. And to do that at a level that allows you to say this is almost or nearly a definitive capital T truth thing, you have to be able to test this back and forth a bunch of times. So that's where I think we almost go in the wrong way sometimes, where we say, where we get ourselves in trouble from a layman's terms or a layman's point of view, is saying that, like, it's either true or not. Mm-hmm. But science is about getting to that point, but it takes a really long point of time to get there.
Mm-hmm. And eggs is a good example, and I can understand the frustration, because you think eggs are good, you think eggs are bad, back and forth. You want an answer, and you have to accept that, like, we don't know, and the we is the collective we as a society driven by science. Something else that often comes up, Steve, in the back and forth is that while science is done by humans, and humans are flawed, so the researcher that wants to make this bold claim that eggs are actually the healthiest food wants to make that claim because he or she wants to be on the cover of a nutrition magazine, or they want to appear on CNN to talk about their provocative research. And the person that is correcting that scientist that wants to say that eggs are worse than smoking, that's also a pretty provocative headline. And they want to become known for it. And they think that maybe they'll get more funding and their colleagues will respect them more. So all of that is true. Science is done by humans. Humans are flawed. I think what people often forget is the flip side of that is letting the egg industry or the vegan food industry tell us what to think. And for every conflict of interest in science, there are 100-fold conflicts of interest outside of science. And that is because, as you mentioned, science is literally set up to self-correct for those conflicts of interest.
Exactly. And it's not only set up to correct for them, but it's also a system set up to acknowledge them, right? So if we look at, dive into the weeds a little bit about how the scientific process works, it's conflicts of interest have to be declared, right? Are they always? Maybe not, but it's in the system, right? Funding sources have to be declared, right? So you're looking at, and then it has to go through a review process, a peer review process of experts in that field who are not related or are not connected to you to see if they can spot any bias, right? Is it a perfect system? No, not at all. But it's at least something that is designed to acknowledge and then do something about these biases that we have as humans. And then the other point on there that I think is important to drive home is that one study doesn't prove anything, really. It's the way we move forward is this propensity of studies where the overwhelming amount of evidence suggests. So that kind of helps weed out this, you know, maybe lone person who says, hey, I want to make a name for myself by studying and biasing my experiment or my theory to get to this provocative place. Well, if the overwhelming majority of others like point out in research and show that this doesn't work, then that self-corrects so that we don't go that way.
So I think it's important to situate this in the current context, which is that science used to play out in labs and obscure peer-reviewed journals. Now, science plays out in the open, on Twitter, on Facebook. I don't know if they're doing science on Instagram these days, probably not, but on the internet. And the internet is an endless journal, an endless newspaper. There are no limitations on space to write about stuff. So every time a provocative result comes out, whether it's the first study on that topic with five people or the 100th with 1,000 people, everybody from paid journalist to Joe Schmo on Twitter is going to want to share that provocative result because it's going to get clicks, attention, followers, and interest. So nothing has really changed about science. What's changed is that it's now happening out in the public step by step. And perhaps that's why we should sit here and talk about it, to educate the public a little bit about what science is and what science isn't. You used to have scientists debating eggs behind closed doors for 2 years and then coming out and saying eggs are good and here's 2 years worth of evidence why. Now it changes on the hour or on the day. And that's not all bad, right? Sunlight and transparency tends to be good. And I think that it makes the scientist a little bit more rigorous and it self-corrects errors because things are exposed so quickly. But the rest of the 7 billion people on this planet want to jump all over these conclusions, even though, as you said, they're not really conclusions, they're small data points. And I think that this plays out particularly in fields where the science is young and as a result more uncertain. So the most extreme example that we're all living through right now is COVID-19. It's a novel virus. It's been around for between, I don't know, depends on who you ask, 4 months to 8 months. And we don't really know anything about it. Nutrition is a fairly young field of science, particularly like with controlled studies. So what do you see in nutrition? You see a lot of, well, you said to eat this. You said carbs are bad. You said fats are bad. Fitness, same thing. Physiology has been around, but exercise science, should you do HIIT or long, slow distance exercise? That's relatively new. So the newer the field, the more uncertainty, the more back and forth that we're left with, and the more room for armchair experts to come in and say, well, science keeps changing its mind, so therefore science is discredited on this topic. Let me tell you what to do. And the most recent example of that is Elon Musk, who is become super confident that he knows more about how developed societies should move forward in the midst of COVID than any of the epidemiologists, virologists, or public health experts studying this disease. For context, oh, Elon Musk has been tweeting like, I've got the answer. The answer is to open up now. The answer, I mean, the answer is to go to Mars. I think that he might have said that, or not in those exact words, but alluded towards that. So for those that are not privy to what's happening on the internet. And that's just one example. You've got a lot of people that are not scientists that seem to be getting very impatient with the scientific process and the uncertainty and are offering their own confidence in a way that is glaringly more confident than the science, but really just based on a hunch.
Yeah. So that's a lot to unpack. So let's start doing that. I think you made a really good point there on that normally this stuff occurs behind closed doors in science. And you might see some of those arguments on like, oh, if we're using a COVID-19 example, oh, the accuracy of the tests, right? That is a normal process. I would encourage anybody to look at, just get on Google Scholar, which allows you to search research journals and put accuracy of antibody tests. And you'll see people arguing back and forth over every single test possible in the literature research journals. It's normal. Now we're just seeing it play out in front of everybody. So it's not something like to be alarmed of, or it's not arguments. It's literally the process trying to sort itself out. So I just wanted to make that point that I think is important here. And, you know, you brought up Musk, and that gets us to this topic of armchair experts, or what I like to call experts of everything. And it's when we almost get impatient to a degree, and then we also overestimate our competence in areas where we don't have expertise in. So not to pick on Musk, but he's a brilliant person who has a lot of expertise in a couple domains. Those domains are not epidemiology. Now, that doesn't mean he might not be right in a regard on his hunch. He could be. He also could be wrong. But I think in the internet era, what we've done is we've given the microphone to people who are very high in confidence, who...
Confidence with the F, yes. Not competence. Yeah, just making sure. Yes. Okay.
Sorry. Very high in confidence. They are like very high in certainty. And because of that, and because they have a platform that gets amplified higher or to a greater degree than the person who is expressing more nuance, right?
And not especially just because they have a platform, because they have that confidence, right? Like we said, science is humble. Scientist is very rarely going to say, this is the answer, and I know it's the answer after 4 months of thinking about this topic. A scientist is going to say, well, based on the current information, this is what we're thinking. Here are all the ways we could be wrong. Whereas Elon Musk, or someone like Elon Musk, is going to say, you guys are taking way too much time. This is the answer. And for a layperson, you're going to believe, well, I shouldn't say what you're going to believe. It's up to you. But it's really enticing to believe the confident person.
Exactly. Because, you know, the uncertainty comes across as almost like, oh, I shouldn't believe that person. Oh, that person doesn't know what they're doing. Because we have this almost inbuilt system where we just judge, right? Where we're judging the accuracy of things. Our brain is saying, like, is this person someone I can trust or not? Do they know what they're doing or not? And for whatever reason, right, confidence is tied to that. If someone comes up to you and says, you know what, like, it might be this, it might be this, that, like, we don't know. And another person comes up to you and says, hey, if you do this, you're going to, you know, make X amount of dollars or have this effect. We're more likely to fall for or believe in the person who comes and gives us this certainty. We hate uncertainty. We hate the unknown. So it's in this current day and age where we have experts of everything, where we have them with a high platform, where we have high confidence, they're going to be selected to go on news shows, to get amplified, etc., than the person who's going to go on and say, well, it could be this, it could be that, we don't know. And I think that brings us to a point of, which is kind of a modern day phenomenon, is that there's no longer a true gatekeeper or filter. That filter is kind of going away, which is both a good thing and a bad thing, right? Where in the past, for example, if you wanted to publish a book, you had to go through a gatekeeper, a publisher that decided, hey, is this worthy or not? Now you can go publish whatever you want anywhere, right? The same with who gets amplified on a voice, right? You used to have some reporter, some newspaper, whatever, think that your voice was worth amplifying. So there was some degree of gatekeeper. Now that's all gone in the social media world. And that, as I said, brings a lot of great things. It brings almost a democracy to things. But it also leads to the fact that voices that should be heard aren't amplified because they're not, they express more nuance than just confidence.
I think that's a really good way to put it. And I think that often it gets juxtaposed as the elitist experts versus everyone else. And there's a little bit of truth to that. And as Steve said, the fact that things are opening up more brings with it a lot of positives. But something that's not positive is that expertise has been, unfortunately, it's been like crowded out in a way. And no, that's not the right word, diluted by all the other stuff out there. So even if you are really looking for expertise, it's hard to find a signal amidst a lot of noise. Again, particularly on topics that are newer, where there is not such a foundation of long-standing science that gets us closer to capital T with a truth. So something that Steve and I have thought a lot about that I think, Steve, now might be a decent time to go into is, okay, so we've set the stage on what science is, what science isn't, and the challenges that science has in the current environment. Well, what does an every layperson, which to an extent is us, we write about this stuff, but neither of us are PhDs, how do you filter through the deluge of information for what is credible and what isn't? And how do you create your own mental model that you can update for what is likely to be true? And man, if you all take away anything from this podcast, from me anyways, I think it's that statement. With so much of this, we are having a mental model or a way of thinking for something that is likely to be true, which is so different than the emotional roller coaster that you get on. Oh my gosh, the virus is mutating. It's going to kill everybody. To actually, it's not so bad. To wait, now 15 children in New York are hospitalized. Does that mean that it's impacting people under two? To actually, another study came out and said that that's something different. That's a really tough space to be in. And you carry that over to all the things you care about. So this is just COVID, but then in other areas of your life, you're low carb, then you're low fat, then you're low sodium, then you're low what? And pretty soon you're eating gluten-free ice cubes. In fitness, you can bounce between all the different models of fitness. This even happens in management where it's like, oh, this is the prevailing theory, but then this person comes out with a theory. So, you know, just for your own sanity, let's go over some guidelines that can help people understand who to listen to, how to filter out bullshit, and a way to think about coming to their own mental model for what's likely to be true, but keeping it flexible enough so you can change your mind. Because otherwise, you're going to be left eating nothing but ice cubes, burying yourself in a bunker in some obscure state. And I don't even know what you do for fitness, Steve. That's more in your wheelhouse.
Sure. So let's go into this. And before, I'm going to outline kind of my bullshit detector of things that I look for. But right before we go into that, I want to make the point that I fall for this stuff too. Okay. And I, you know, Brad, I'm sure is the same. You know, there have been podcasts that I've listened to of people who I respect and all that good stuff, who all of a sudden I'm listening and they step into my domain of, let's say, exercise or running or exercise science. And all of a sudden an alarm goes off and I'm like, wait a minute, that's wrong. Like you're providing wrong information. And it almost makes me step back and think like, wait a minute, I'm listening to all your information on all these other subjects, but you're wrong in the one area I know. Are you right or wrong in all these other areas that you're talking about? I don't know. And that's a problem. So it's a process that occurs to me as well. So
let's make this real for a second. And you know, if we lose a listener or two here, that's fine. Like Joe Rogan's a really good example of this. And if you listen to that podcast, like Joe Rogan is super smart. I wouldn't call him a polymath because he's not an expert on all these things. And I sometimes would listen to that podcast and I'd find it really interesting. But then to Steve's point, I'd hear him make a statement that just makes zero sense. And it makes me question everything else he's talking about. So like that's an example that makes it real. And I'm not saying Joe Rogan is evil and you shouldn't listen to his podcast or you should. All I'm saying is, you know, we've used Elon Musk a lot. Well, he doesn't have a podcast. And podcasting, somebody that exemplifies this is like the Joe Rogan Experience. The Joe Rogan Experience is lots of super interesting things completely showered in confidence that might be legit, but might be overconfidence. Sorry, I just had to fire some shots in here. We're talking in abstracts. So I want to make this real.
All right. Take the shots. Go ahead. I've done enough of that in my life, so I'll turn it over to you. But I you know, I think that is worth mentioning because it is like, gosh, there's been so many podcasts where they've talked about running or endurance, and I'm like, oh my gosh, you're so wrong. And it makes me question things.
Sorry, one more interjection and then I'll really shut up. And like listeners, hold us to that too.
Yes.
Like if we're telling you what to think more often than we're telling you how to think on any topic, like email us, tweet at us, leave a shitty review. Like maybe don't do that, but let us know because it's an easy trap to fall into. And like, to be super meta, we don't want to be like the gurus on guru syndrome. What we want to do is give you tools how to think because we're not a peer reviewed journal on every single topic in the world. And I think that's the problem. Like, that's the Joe Rogan Experience. You can't have one person suddenly be the equivalent of a peer-reviewed journal on every topic in the world.
Yes. And I maybe instead of leaving a bad review, let us know so that we can learn from it. but I agree. I think it's that it's almost like this. The way I like to look at it is it's like the difference between searching and researching. Okay, and we get these wrong, but it's the same word as in their search, but one has re in it, right? And I realize this is really simple, but re means doing it over and over and over again, right? In today's world, we're really good at searching. We're good at going on Google, like typing in our question and finding a quick answer, and then that making us feel like we know the answer to our problem. But if we go a layer deeper, from the superficial level of searching to the deep, we understand that it's really complex and our simple answer might not be absolutely true, right? There's more depth to it. And researching would be, you know, when I've worked on a study or research project, like it is reading, talking to, understanding like hundreds of different research articles, right? Even when I wrote something like The Science of Running, which wasn't peer-reviewed, I think I read probably 1,000 or more different research articles on the science of exercise in relation to running, right? So there's a difference there, and we're not saying you always have to be on the research side. It can be somewhere in between there, but this idea of if who you're listening to, if they're giving you proclamations, you want them to be closer to the research side than the search side.
Yeah.
So just
that's
to
a good
make
point.
That
in people that do that, I think someone that has come to do this really well in his career is Malcolm Gladwell, who now will say that, hey, my books are meant to be read as like interesting ideas to get you thinking. They are not meant to be read as, this chapter says hold your kid back and he'll be a better athlete, so you should start holding your kid back. To Gladwell, and hopefully to his readers, that is, huh, like these little things can make a big difference down the line. That's the point of that chapter. The point is not to actually hold your kid back.
Yeah, you know, I think that that's a great example. And I've really come, you know, early in my career, I didn't like Gladwell's stuff as much because in college and grad school and this stuff, we were kind of taught Gladwell was like the person who didn't use science well as an example. I remember writing a paper on that in grad school. But what I've really come to realize and notice is just that great point, is Gladwell is really good at admitting when he's wrong and changing his mind and then framing his thesis in his books as interesting things to start as a jumping off standpoint, not as the definitive answer. And I think if more people understood that, we'd be in a better place, right? They're not the answer. They're a jumping off point to explore ideas.
And it's a good example on being willing to admit that you're wrong for everyone involved. So Malcolm, if you're listening, hello. Right before Peak Performance came out, Steve took to Medium and wrote this like long manifesto about how our book is like the anti-Malcolm Gladwell book because it's actually based in science. And I remember Malcolm calling Steve and being like, Steve, the heck are you doing, man? Like, this is not the time to be making enemies. We've got a book coming out in 2 days. And the funny thing is, now half of Malcolm Gladwell's tweets are like quoting or retweeting Steve. So everybody there has changed their mind. That's all I have to add to that.
To be fair, that was my grad school paper modified a little bit.
So we Malcolm Steve plagiarized himself. So there's some
I did. For your Twitter feed. I self plagiarized my own work, which is actually a thing, which is interesting.
But Joe Rogan, anyways, we can make peace too. Maybe it's going to be harder.
All right.
Joe Rogan's so, probably like, I want to fight you in a cage, Brad. Okay. Anyway, back on topic.
Back on topic. All right. So lesson there, learn from your mistakes, get over them, admit you're wrong. A couple quick things on BS detecting. So this is, again, just a couple things that I'll go over really quickly on things I'm looking for, whether this person's like knows what they're talking about or is a purveyor of BS. And quickly down my list that I've accumulated over the years is first is when people try to make a topic or an idea much more complex than it needs to be. And their idea is there to use complexification to create confusion to make it seem like, oh, this person knows what they're talking about because I, the listener, do not. Right? That's number one. Number two. These all kind
Steve,
of play
can
off
you give
each
an
other.
Example? Can you give an example of the complexification? Give me a straightforward example, because I think the thing to how might you be wrong is what about people that oversimplify things that are actually complex? So how do you know and how do you navigate that?
Yeah, so that's a good question, and I don't have the answer to that. But the way I kind of look at it is complexification is. When you take something, let me think of an example. When you take the sport of running, I'm going to stick in my area, right? And you take interval training, for example, okay? Doing something hard, resting, coming back for more, okay? And instead of just talking about interval training, right, you wrap it up and this kind of complexity of, hey, if you do high intensity interval training, it will activate such and such pathways, and then this will happen, mm-hmm. this will happen, and then you're going to get better through that, right? Mm-hmm. That might not be the best example, but when you're taking something that for the layperson, they don't need to understand this behind it, and B, we don't have the answer to it, and then wrapping it in this super complex explanation to try and convince me that they know what they're talking about. Does that kind of make sense?
Makes total sense. Whereas if it was scientist to scientist, those details and that complexity is important.
Exactly.
So if you've got two physiologists and they're, you know, well, the mTOR pathway is activating, but glycosis is turned off and bialactate is flushing, that's all really important and meaningful for them to get a more nuanced definition of what's going on. But if you've got some podcast host telling somebody that's doing a couch to 5K program about their mTOR and glycosis, that's bullshit.
Exactly. And not to plug my book, but I'm going to do it anyways. Science of Running. So
don't
if you
read
look
it
at
if you're a couch to 5K person.
Yes, do not read it. But here's
no,
what
No, no, maybe read it. I'm saying don't read it if you're a couch to 5K person.
Yeah, no, that's what I mean.
It's going to put you on the couch forever. You're going to be like, holy shit.
What is this? But here's why I'm going to point this out. The first half of this book is incredibly complex in science, okay? And I point that out. It's all the science to as much as you want to know about running. The second half is still a little complex, but it's all coaching and very little science, right? Mm. So the first half is written for a grad level exercise science background if you want it, right? But you could also just skip that. And if you're just a distant cross-country high school, college level coach, skip it entirely and go to the coaching section, which is all about training, right? It doesn't include as much of the complex stuff. And it was written that way for a reason, because, like, again, you have to know your audience, and you're not trying to prove, like, hey, I know this to convince someone. You're trying to talk to the audience that you have. So hopefully that dichotomy makes sense.
Yeah, it's a very good book, Steve. I was able to make it through the first half. And book publishers, man, I'm just having too much fun on this podcast. If you are out there, there is a repackage and rebrand of The Science of Running that is a good book. So show Steve the money. Seriously, guys, publishers, you might not know this. It's the most authoritative book on running and science. And Steve wrote it in a pinch when he was basically getting ready to leave his job because he's a well-charactered whistleblower. He wrote it with no help from anyone. He wrote it before he'd really been writing. And the book continues to sell well because it's so good. Dress that book up in a new cover, get it some professional editing, show Steve the money.
There you go. Look at this. We're trying to make me money. I love this. Just quickly going down the rest of the list, and this ties into the first one, is what I call, like, use scienciness. So using words that sound scientific to give the lure of understanding, or using things that almost have these ambiguous names that are kind of scientific, like the word toxins, right? Which you hear all the time in the health and fitness and nutrition area, where it's like, oh, take this, drink this juice, and it will clear out toxins. Well, what in the world in your body is a toxin, right? And why is a juice going to clear it out? Again, it sounds like toxins is bad, and it sounds like a biology term that has meaning, but it really doesn't have meaning.
I think that's a great example. Unless you're talking to somebody that is in the business of toxicology, or you're calling poison control, anyone that tells you anything about clearing out toxins, probably wise to be skeptical about what they've got to say.
Exactly. Another one that I'll point out is when we have fixation. So fixation on one pathway in a very complex system as the answer. So it is, you know, this thing is the cure all. And I'll give you an example from COVID-19, because it's fresh on my mind. I saw a video go viral of some doctor, I don't know his credentials. I'm doubting them now, but his claim was that we just needed to give people massive injections of vitamin C. And that
you're doubting him now? I was doubting him 2 seconds into that video.
I know. No, that's what I meant. But massive injections of vitamin C as the answer, right?
Orange juice. And that went,
yes. We all need to take orange juice and inject it into ourselves. So, like, when you have a very complex problem, like a novel virus, and the answer is very simple on, oh, this is easy, immune system, vitamin C, like, just douse it with this, then you should have red flags going left and right all over the place right now. Another one that comes along with that is what I'll call manufacturing and exploiting doubt. So it's intentionally creating doubt at the beginning to get you to then believe or buy into what they are selling or the idea they're giving,
right? So it's creating this distrust, and you see this a lot in creating a distrust of experts or a distrust of what the media is telling you or a distrust of everybody, whatever it is. Again, multiple examples in COVID-19, and they're doing that doubt so that they can then give you the answer so that you're willing and able to accept something that you probably likely wouldn't.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really good. I think you see that a lot in diet.
Yes, 100%. And then the last
carbohydrate is behind this, or big dairy, or big meat, or big vegan.
Big vegan. No, that's those are great examples. And it's like whenever you can, because it's whenever you create that doubt of like, oh, big dairy behind it is behind this. Look at all this funding, and they're just trying to fool you and stuff like that. It makes you willing and open to accept whatever is going to come next, which is inevitably, almost always, them selling you something to make like a profit off of like right, this exploiting. Yes.
But I'm all for good almond milk, Steve. I recently, like 2 weeks ago, out of nowhere, I became lactose intolerant in a pretty gnarly way. Caitlin, for those of you that don't know, Caitlin's my wife. Caitlin will not sleep in the same room as me after I eat dairy products.
Well, that is a great detail to know. So I'm glad that.
So I've got nothing wrong with big dairy. Excuse me, I've got nothing wrong with good almond milk. It looks like it's going to be a bigger part of my life in the future. But back to topic. Man, I don't know what got into me this morning. I think a really good example of this is Michael Pollan. So Michael Pollan, his advice to lay people on food is eat real food, mostly plants, not too much. Eat real food, stuff that's not wrapped in plastic, mostly plants, a lot of produce and greens, not too much. Calories in, calories out. If Michael Pollan is going to go get into a discussion with scientists, it's going to be a lot more complex than that. But for a layperson, that's really all you need to know. So I think that's a good example tying some of your earlier principles together.
Yeah, I think that's a great example. It's like knowing your audience and knowing what tends to matter there. And
yeah,
and
it's like an exercise with a general with a more novice audience. And I can't really take credit for this. I can take as much credit as Steve. Steve and I are in an email group with a lot of people that like to think about exercise in particular. And I guess I give the whole group credit is we kind of came to this where it's like move your body sometimes hard, every bit counts. And that's really all you need to know about exercise unless you're trying to get to deeper levels of expertise.
Right. Unless if you're trying to become world class at some form of exercise, then you have to do more. For the vast majority of us, it gets, not to go completely off topic, but it gets back to something that we harp on all the time, is if most people nail the basics, then they're going to be good. And those are the basics.
Yeah, but you can't sell an entire industry on move your body sometimes hard, every bit counts.
Nope, you cannot. So that is the problem. And then last one I'll mention on my BS detector before we move on is...
And I'm going to ask you to recap at the end, Steve, because I've done a wonderful job going on tangents.
Yeah, good luck with that. The last one I'll mention is this idea of communal reinforcement, which is when someone relies on like a very... relies on a small circle to kind of propagate and confirm their beliefs. Mm-hmm. So it's what tends to happen, you know, we've talked about diet a lot, but it's what tends to happen in diet cults, right? Actually, our friend Matt Fitzgerald once wrote a pretty good book on the topic called Diet Cults. But what happens is, you know, we'll say the anti-carb people will like propagate and confirm their beliefs among each other until they all believe that, hey, this is the one true way. And then the opposite side, we'll say the anti-fat, whatever, people do the same thing. And it just blows my mind. But it's like how these ideas spread is if they can get you in this inner circle where the beliefs just keep confirming, then that circle grows and all of a sudden we have this movement that is resistant to thinking or understanding, and, you know, just keeps going.
And I'm going to stay values neutral because I don't know if this is good or bad. I'll leave that up to you all to form an opinion. But it's interesting to note that you can track the decline of organized dogmatic religion. So particularly in the West, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, less people going to church, to mosque, to synagogue, at the same time as cult-like behavior in other areas have gone up. So you go from being religious to being a keto person, or you go from being religious to being a Democrat or a Republican. Again, I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just noting that we've always had this tribal nature. For the past 2,000 years, it's been rooted in religion. And now as that slowly breaks down, we're filling that tribal need elsewhere. Anti-vaccine is another example. That has become like a fervent religion of radicals. And we've got less radical religious people, but now we've got anti-vaccine people.
That's interesting. I hadn't really thought about that much, but that's an interesting correlation there.
That would be plug for my next book that will come out anywhere from 1 to 7 years. We go a little bit deeper on that.
Interesting.
All right. Anyways, recap, Steve, because we want to leave people with some concrete, tangible advice, not just my tangents. So let's hear the very succinct version of what to look out for when you are entering the deluge of information and kind of how to parse out who maybe you shouldn't take seriously or who you should question at the very least.
I will give my best attempt. So recapping. Does the person look like they are searching or did they research, right? Are they complexifying? Are they using scienciness, right? Big word syndrome, toxins, etc. Are they fixated on one pathway as the answer? This is it. Are they using doubt? Are they trying to create doubt in you to get you to believe or sell you something? And then finally, communal reinforcement. Are they trying to get you into the club or other ways, the cult, so that they can have you believe this and spread their ideas? If you see someone using or understanding or utilizing those things, it doesn't mean absolutely they're wrong, right? But it means that your antenna should go up. Just like when I hear someone say something and exercise my domain on a podcast where my antenna goes up for everything else they say. It doesn't mean that I shouldn't listen to all their other advice or they could be wrong, like Brad talked about in Joe Rogan. But my antenna should go up when I am listening to it to ask, does this person giving this information really have the expertise to be able to do so, and is their thinking clear enough to have an understanding or an opinion on the topic?
And I think it's important too, before you just like throw the baby out with the bathwater here, I think a sign of a mature, well-adapted adult is being able to listen to someone and throw some stuff that they say out while believing other things. So there are people that I think are really good go-to sources on topic A, but anytime they talk about B, I kind of like put my hands over my eyes, or what's the expression? Put my head in my hands and be like, oh, I can't believe they're now talking about topic B, but I don't totally discard them because when they're talking about topic A, they're really on point. And people are human. You know, like a prime example is there was a great interview recently with Michael Lewis, who's a phenomenal nonfiction writer. And for a little segment of the interview, they started talking about what maybe you could classify as mental health. And Michael Lewis was just saying stuff that made me cringe. And I had this visceral, like, gut reaction to be like, screw this guy. I shouldn't listen to anything he's saying. But everything else that he said in the other 94 minutes of the conversation on writing was spot on. So I think it's really important to be able to realize that people aren't perfect. And just because you throw out A doesn't mean that you can't listen to someone on B. And of course, Michael Lewis might be spouting crap on mental health. He's not a mental health professional. He hasn't experienced depression. So he's just sharing his own experience. So again, like, I use the bullshit detector there, but I didn't say everything Michael Lewis is saying is bullshit. I'm like, he's just having a conversation. He's not an expert on this. So therefore, what he says on this, I'm not going to listen to, but everything else that he talked about in his area of expertise makes sense. If Elon Musk called me up and started telling me about electric cars, I'd probably listen, even though I think he's batshit crazy as an armchair epidemiologist. How's that?
I think that is a great, great way to tie this up a little bit. Listen to Musk on electric cars or maybe rockets, but and definitely how to create PayPal, but not epidemiology. And I think
Elon Musk created PayPal.
He was, yeah, that's how he got his fortune initially.
I didn't know that. Interesting.
He was, I don't know, he was like, I don't know Musk's biography.
One of the first people or investors?
Yeah, but he was one of the co-founders or something like that of PayPal. So
that's fascinating. Maybe, not to make this the Analyze Elon Musk show, because we don't want to do that, and maybe Elon Musk's real skill is just like radical ideas. And some work out, and some, like, focusing on Mars is a way to free America now, don't work out.
Well, you know, to tie this to baseball a little bit, because I kind of like this analogy, baseball. is that you have some guys who are home run hitters, right? Who are the guys who take the big swings, but also strike out a lot, right? And you have others who hit for a high average, but might not hit many home runs, right? You need both in society, right? But you also need to know when you'd like to have the hitter, the average hitter up, the Ichiro Suzuki up, who's going to hit a lot of, put up a lot of balls in play and a lot of times get on base. And when you need the home run hitter, or when you need the guy who can, like, who has a really good eye and doesn't swing a lot and can take walks.
It's a great example, man. And if you're in a tie game in the bottom of a ninth inning and there's two outs and the bases are loaded, and if you don't win this game, you're done. You want Ichiro up there to knock one through the hole.
Exactly.
I think that's a great analogy. And if you're down three runs and there's two outs and you're in the bottom of the ninth, you probably want the home run hitter that's going to swing for the fences and give you a last-ditch shot at making a crazy comeback. Man, that's a great analogy, Steve.
You know, every once in a while, my brain comes up with something good.
Yeah, well, we'll take it. All right, so here we go. I feel the obligation to do a large summary of this episode, since I am the reason that we got off track a couple times here. We talked about science. We talked about how science is a process of thinking, and science is more about how to think than what to think. And that is one of science's inherent vulnerabilities, is that it thinks in probabilities of something being true, not in certainties. And our brains are wired to crave certainty. So this creates a gap for people that are not actually scientists to come in and make these overconfident certain claims. And we have to be very careful about when we're listening to those people. Steve went over what he calls his bullshit detector, which are ways to spot this kind of false certainty. And those include things like making somewhat simple concepts sound really complex, using all kinds of big words and mechanisms when what the person actually just needs to know is what to do. Steve, throw out some of your other examples. I lost track there for a bit.
Yeah, so complexification, scienciness, fixation on one pathway, yep. Manufactured doubt.
Love it. And then we also just briefly touched upon the fact that just because someone is off in area A doesn't mean that you can't listen to them in area B and totally discard them. It's human nature to kind of overstretch your boundaries, your expertise. It just means maybe don't go to them for the area that they are overstretching. And then I think the overarching theme to pick up from this episode is, again, that science is a model for how to think, It is not searching. It is researching. It is updating beliefs based on the best available evidence. So you want to try to embody that mindset in all areas of your own life. And if you do that, you're going to be on the right track. It's less about the destination and more about staying on the right track and changing course when you need to. And I would argue that that is a very, very good mindset for living a good, high-performing, healthy life. Because if you get too focused on the destination, you're going to be going to Rome one day and then going to Africa the next day and then joining me in Oakland the next day, because things change fast. So try to stay on the right path, less than getting obsessed about particular answers.
Love it. And you know what? I was right at the beginning. This was a very interesting topic. So I hope, at least to me it was. So I hope that all of you listeners really enjoyed this. If you can do us a favor, it really helps, is go online, rate it. If, like Brad said, you think we're full of BS and you want to rate it poorly, that's fine, whatever. But we'd love you to...
No, I thought they're supposed to email us first if they feel like that.
That's right. They are.
If you love it, rate it. If you think we're full of crap, email us.
So we can
get
better.
Give us a chance to take your feedback so we can get better. And then rate us saying how open-minded we were and how we improved.
All right. I love it. So,
but in all seriousness, those things really matter. Yes. And it's funny. At the start, I tell Steve, I'm like, I always feel awkward asking for people to rate and review us. So can you do it? And here I am cutting Steve off to do it. It makes a big difference. It's how other people find out about the podcast. It helps us get boosted in the podcast algorithms on the various internets. And it just broadens the reach of this discussion, which we think is a good thing.
Yes. And if you really enjoyed this episode, share it with a friend, share it with work, coworkers, team, whatever. Thanks a lot. All feedback is welcome. And until next time, figure out how to think.
And wash your hands. Thanks for listening to the Growth Equation Podcast. Learn more about our work and find show notes at our website, www.thegrowtheq.com. Follow us on Twitter, at B. Stahlberg and at Steve Magnus. And if you like what you listen to, please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast, as this goes a long way in helping it reach others.